Have you or any of your loved ones experienced trauma? And have you ever wanted to understand it better? Today, I'll share the facts and the myths about trauma as we currently understand it in the field of mental health.
Welcome to The Happy Wizard. I'm your host, Dr. Shiva Guide. I'm a board-certified and licensed clinical psychologist, a public speaker, and an educator. In this podcast series, I'll be sharing strategies to help you heal from the past, navigate everyday challenges, and create a much more meaningful life.
Hi, I'm Dr. G, and I'm happy to talk to you today about the science that informs our current understanding of trauma. So welcome to part two of our What is Trauma episodes. In the first episode of our trauma series, I introduced some basic ideas and some statistics related to trauma. And, you know, some of that information I think might have surprised you. At the very least, I hope that you found it thought-provoking and you're curious to learn more about trauma so that either you can help yourself or maybe you can better understand someone close to you that might be suffering from symptoms of trauma. So I just wanted to just summarize because maybe the last time you listened to the previous episode, it's been a few days or weeks or months. So let's just summarize some of the important points from our first session that we started to lay the groundwork. Then that'll lay the groundwork also for what we're going to talk about today. I think it's helpful to review new information because it takes learning. Sometimes it takes repetition. So here's a reminder, and here are some of the main points that we discussed. First of all, trauma is a more general term, and it's a pretty vague one. People often use the word trauma to mean different things. Sometimes they're referring to the traumatic event itself. Sometimes they're referring to the short or long-term consequences of that traumatic event. Whatever the case, in the clinical world of mental health and medicine, trauma usually refers to some sort of life-threatening event that occurs to you or someone very close to you. Trauma, the second point that we made in the last episode was that trauma affects us in many different ways. It affects us both internally and externally. And we discussed these in detail. So if you need a refresher, go back to the part one. There are also a set of symptoms that are very commonly experienced by people who've gone through a traumatic experience. And most of these symptoms will go away in the weeks and months that follow trauma. But for a smaller percentage of people, you know, getting stuck basically means that they're going to continue experiencing symptoms more chronically until they get professional help. And that, in, you know, what we're talking about is like therapy and medication. Another really important point that I want to emphasize is that trauma is trauma. You know, although I've seen over the years that people like to identify with their specific type of trauma as though it's unique and different from all kinds of other traumas and should be distinguished from other types of traumas, I will tell you, by and large, it's all the same in the way that it manifests clinically. And that means that the way that it shows up in your life, and then if you were to go into treatment, how would we strategize? How would we navigate through your recovery? It's all the same. And another huge point that I made in the last episode that I will reemphasize is that natural recovery is the most common outcome. The vast majority of people recover after experiencing something traumatic. And by vast majority, what I mean is 70 to 90% of people. It's really a much smaller group of people that don't recover and somehow just get stuck. So this is what leads us to this topic of today that I'm really going to get into the weeds and nerd out a little bit, is the why. You know, why do some people, the minority of people, get stuck? Probably the most comprehensive and best explanation for why some people get sick and get stuck after trauma is something that we call the stress diathesis or the stress vulnerability model. I did discuss this in detail in my Stress versus Distress podcast. So if you want to get into the weeds of that, you can definitely listen to that episode. This model is essentially a theory that explains disease manifestation And what I mean by that is, you know, the development of disease. We could also call it psychopathology, right? How do these psychological symptoms develop into an actual disorder or disease? And what are the contributing factors? So the stress diathesis model really best describes why this smaller percentage of people may develop more long-lasting disorder, you know, whatever the disorder, whether it's a mood disorder or an anxiety disorder or a trauma disorder or something else. And this theory, what I love about it is that it really highlights just how complex the nature of disease in general, not just brain disease, but all kinds of disease. It's never really one thing alone that's causing pathology. It's a very multifactorial process in terms of what leads to the development of most psychiatric disorders. Some of the early studies on this were looking at psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. So what do I mean by multifactorial? I mean, it's pretty obvious by the word. It's basically the idea that there are multiple factors, many contributing factors that come together, and they sort of just create this perfect storm. Or maybe you can think of it as, you know, all these different factors come together and you hit this critical mass point, and that's when things go downhill. I'll go into a lot more detail in the next episode on PTSD specifically, since it is the most popular and talked about trauma disorder. But for right now, I'll refer to, you know, statistics and findings specifically about PTSD just as an example, and to further explain or clarify how the stress diathesis model works, for example. And I hope that this makes it easier for you to understand why some people get sick and other people don't. So to do this, we have to take a look at some of the known risk factors and things that make people, certain people, more vulnerable to developing, for example, PTSD. And again, we're just going to use this as an example. One thing we know is that gender plays a huge role. Women, for whatever reason, are 2 times more likely, so twice more likely to develop PTSD than men. There's also genetics, right? Genetics tells us that if you have a family history of psychiatric disease, for example, specifically you have family members who have a clinically significant level of anxiety, that increases your risk. So I use the term clinically significant level because the truth is, the reality is most people don't ever go get diagnosed or treated. They just kind of live and suffer in silence. Just to squirrel for a minute, by the way, and normalize this for all of you, in this country, about 1 in 3 people has been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, right? I mean, 1 in 3 people go into a room, count off every third person. But that's still only the people who actually went and saw a doctor and got the diagnosis. So take a second to think about how many people in your own life, maybe including you, can you think of who you believe probably meet criteria for an anxiety disorder, but have not gone into a doctor. So, okay, what does this mean? My guess is the actual stats maybe double this, right? So I would guess well over half the population has suffered from or suffers from an anxiety disorder. Okay, but I digress. All right, so we have gender, we have genetics, and what about our biology? Biology is a little different than genetics. Genetics is sort of our DNA, what we inherit. Biology refers to sort of the anatomical and physiological differences that we might have that might increase our risk. You know, we have our genetics, but biology, I like to think of it as the interaction between your genetics and the environment. We can think of that sort of never ending controversy of nature versus nurture, that argument. We also have to look at childhood factors, and this is very significant because that may also put us at risk. This includes having a history of trauma or family dysfunction, addiction in the family, and that's also a very highly heritable or genetic disorder. Prenatal and childhood stress might lead to you being programmed, as for lack of a better word, for stress reactivity. This is just to squirrel off for a second. This is a focus of a really new, exciting field that's emerging, a subfield, and it's called epigenetics. This is the idea that neurons that wire together fire together. And if you're a science nerd like me, you probably have heard this before. So it's a very interesting, interesting field that's kind of looking much deeper at our genetic predispositions. To squirrel off for a minute again, the human brain tends to develop bottom up. What that means is like the more primitive parts of our brain, like the limbic system, right? That's where our amygdala lives, develop first. So what that means for development is that overreactive or overactive stress responses in the lower levels of brain will eventually impact the development of the higher levels of the brain, like your prefrontal cortex, you know, in the frontal lobe. And those are the parts of the brain that develop last, usually in our, you know, by our early to mid 20s. That's how long it takes for the brain to fully develop. Okay, so back to the stress diathesis model. What are these contributing factors? So we've already reviewed gender, and we have genetics and biology, and then childhood factors. And now we have to think about the environment. So there are environmental factors that can really impact us as well. And these are things like disasters, genocide, civil war, mass violence, some of these kind of more pervasive and sometimes ongoing environmental situations that people are growing up in. It's repeated trauma over time, essentially. And that can really increase the risk of disease development. We also have psychological factors. And of course, that always plays a really important role. And what we're talking about here is like a pre-existing history of mental illness. So if you had an anxiety disorder or depression, or just anxiety symptoms or depression, diagnosed or not, from an early age, because it does run in your family and you have the biology and the genetics and the predisposition vulnerabilities there, then you might actually be at higher risk for developing something like PTSD following a traumatic event down the line, right? Later on in your life. And, you know, okay, let's like think intelligently about this organ called the brain. It's like any other organ, right? So we don't have to feel ashamed about this. And as I throw this idea out there, if mental illness runs in your family, it's really no different than diabetes or high blood pressure or cardiovascular problems or cancer or autoimmune disease or, you know, allergies or everything else that can run in families. So does brain disease. It runs in families. So let's not feel ashamed of it. Let's just have an honest conversation and own it, because we want to take good care of this organ. It's the most important one. It runs everything. And then one final contributing factor I want to highlight is physical trauma or physical injury. So what I mean by this is if you have a concussion, the new fancy term for this, by the way, is traumatic brain injury, right? TBI. But it's just a concussion. And most concussions tend to be mild and people tend to recover and have no long-term consequences. Pretty much like any other illness or injury or disease, you know, things run on a spectrum from like mild or minimal to severe. And obviously, the more severe the physical injury to your organ or organ system, you know, the higher risk of psychopathology. Okay, so those are your contributing factors. So let me give you a hypothetical example just to highlight the way this model or theory, the stress diathesis or stress vulnerability model, works and how it translates into the real world and explains the development of a disease or a disorder. And this should really clarify things for you if you're not totally clear on this multifactorial theory that I just presented. So I'll use the word you just to bring it home and make it simple, right? I'm not mind reading or anything. So if you're out there and you're like, oh my God, Dr. G's like in my head, she knows my life, then, you know, don't freak out. After doing this work for a couple of decades, you just kind of do start seeing the same thing over and over. These are very common, universal human experiences. So let's say, for example, that you grew up in a family where nobody really ever talked about their feelings. And especially if you were a boy, you were probably taught, like verbally and non-verbally, that, like, God forbid, don't be a crybaby, don't cry like a little girl, don't be a pussy. If you were a girl, same thing. I mean, you could have just generally been raised in an emotionally constipated family. Or maybe if you cried, the adults around you thought they were helping you by telling you to stop. It's not a big deal. Stop crying. You're just trying to get attention. You're not really hurt. Or in some way, they were just invalidating your feelings. So maybe the reason that everybody's like that is that not only is that how they were raised by, you know, emotionally constipated grownups, but they also had their own demons to deal with and they never dealt with them. So like maybe dad or mom have a history of trauma and mom tends to isolate and worry about everything. She's like the control freak that drives you nuts because she's always worrying about something bad happening. And then she gets depressed and then goes into her bedroom for the whole weekend and sleeps and really has just time limited interactions with you or anybody else. And then dad is an angry alcoholic with a really bad temper. So now what you've learned by the ripe old age of 10 is that the world is a very scary place. Danger is everywhere. You can't trust people. And if you're overwhelmed, just go and hide. Go isolate. But dad's also taught you that the way to deal with distress or being upset is by getting angry, drinking, slamming a door, leaving the house pissed off, jumping in the car, you know, driving really fast, or even like we can take it to the extreme and worst case scenario that when things get upsetting, the way to respond is hitting someone or something. So like some kind of physical aggression is the best way to communicate and cope. So now you're in the mix of all that unhealthy and all that dysfunction at a point when your human brain, your child brain, is not even like a third developed. The human brain, again, it doesn't fully develop until about the early to mid 20s. You know, so that's like a lot of crazy, unhealthy shit to be learning at an age when your brain is really so sensitive to the environment. And like we just said, it's the primitive parts of your brain that kind of respond to and develop the reactivity to stress that are developing first. And that will ultimately impact the higher level sort of prefrontal cortex, frontal lobe development. So it can really set us up for problems. You've inherited that genetic and biological vulnerability that increases the chances of you having your own problems, I mean like mental illness, down the line. Now, because mom and dad are so unhealthy and they're just unable to do better at that time, you know, you get ignored and neglected. And let's say, you know, you didn't really learn or you're not learning healthy boundaries. And so nobody notices when the babysitter or your uncle or the family friend or neighbor or your priest at your local church starts sexually abusing you. Child abuse of all kinds, emotional, verbal, physical, sexual, whatever we're talking about, they're most often perpetrated by the people closest to us, the people that have access to us when we're children. So if this happened to you, first of all, my heart aches for you. No child should experience this. But the tragic reality is that this early trauma sets you up for a lot more problems down the line. Now, I use child abuse as one example, but other traumas that you might have experienced growing up include neighborhood violence, like gang-related activities, or maybe witnessing domestic violence between your parents or grown-ups, or being severely bullied or harassed or tortured in school growing up. And really, the list just goes on and on. But anyway, so now basically what we're talking about is you've got the genetics, you modeled some unhealthy behaviors and interactions from the adults around you in your life, and then let's say on top of that, you were exposed to trauma early in life. And of course, I'm using some pretty extreme examples just to demonstrate the stress diathesis model. Okay, so now you're a young adult. And you're, you know, just to be honest, your adult lifestyle is not very healthy. You abuse alcohol. That means you drink a few drinks or more, at least a few nights a week. And that will be discussed in further detail in a podcast on substance use. If any of you right now are feeling irritated to hear this, you clam up and you don't talk about how you're feeling, another very unhealthy behavior. So basically what I'm saying is you're emotionally constipated too. And you find lots of ways to avoid when you are in distress. So instead of facing or coming, you know, towards that anxiety provoking situation, you avoid. And there are many, many, many tricky little ways to avoid. You also have a really unhealthy story to begin with, right? A worldview that's full of lots of unhelpful beliefs like, you know, I can't trust people. I can only rely on myself. People don't care. So what's the point? Why bother? Talking about my feelings makes me weak. It makes me a loser. If I ignore the problem, it'll just go away. You know, and on and on. There are probably a gazillion more thoughts of doom and fucking gloom that you could go into. Some of you are real experts at that. And now you're an adult, right? And you're adulting, or at least you're trying, right? And everything in the adult world just takes and takes and takes and takes. Your time, your money, your energy. You know, so there's really a lot of real life stressors that you have to cope with on a daily basis, right? Bills, work, grocery shopping, laundry, dishes, and all these other activities of daily living. We in the field use the acronym ADLs, that stands for activities of daily living. And all this adulting is hard, right? It's not impossible. And in an ideal universe, we have it all under control because we have lots of resources available to us. But, you know, nonetheless, I mean, these ADLs still use up resources, right? And if you're low on resources, then you sort of that stress might turn into distress, right? So the balance has been tipped. And finally, now leading up to you experience a trauma or another trauma, if you've already had trauma earlier in your life, and it just puts you over the edge, right? And you get stuck. You don't see a doctor. You don't talk about it. You start drinking excessively. You start avoiding people, places, activities, situations, or anything anxiety provoking, right? And then you develop PTSD. And the problem is once you develop the disorder, it's just a downhill spiral from there that you really, you won't be able to break out of because you actually start believing that stinking thinking story that you're telling yourself. And your life just shrinks. It just becomes very small. I mean, so small that at some point you might not even want to leave your house. You might not even want to leave your bedroom. For those of you that are listening and you can relate to any part of this, my guess is that the COVID pandemic, quarantine time, that period, especially after the lockdown, you probably loved it. You were like, fuck yeah, I can isolate and I'm just being a good citizen because I'm not spreading the super virus. And you could order alcohol straight to your door, so minimal accountability, right, for drinking. And the driving drunk issue is totally eliminated as long as you stay home. So needless to say, and you know who you are out there, that this past 2 years has probably not helped the situation if you had PTSD even before this global trauma. My guess is maybe things may have even gotten worse. So this whole hypothetical story puts all those pieces together, right? And when I stated in the last podcast episode, part one of this, that although a smaller percentage of people develop a trauma disorder, PTSD being one of them, still, you understand now that there are very legitimate, explainable, and comprehensible reasons for it. You're not crazy. You're not weak. You're not damaged beyond repair. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not defective. And, you know, although you may not feel like it, you are inherently a worthwhile human being. There's nothing wrong with you. You're just sick. You're ill. Right? This is a sickness of an organ, the most important organ. And just like if there were something wrong with any other organ or organ system, you'd probably go to the doctor, right? We have to go to the doctor, period. Back to the PTSD and trauma discussion. Are you connecting the dots now, folks? Do you understand why you or someone that you know might be or have been at higher risk from the very beginning to develop trauma symptoms or some kind of chronic mental illness? You know, it's an interesting thing. When I started out in this field a couple decades ago, and that we were using kind of a prior iteration of the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which is sort of the Bible of psychiatric disease, I was first trained in the field, and we used to say, you know, there was this expression about PTSD or trauma symptoms, and people would say, okay, it's expected reactions to unexpected life events. But actually, that thought, that belief has actually evolved and changed quite a bit in recent years. And now we know it's just not true. Although traumatic life experiences may be unexpected, and typically they are, the most common outcome is natural recovery. So having a severe or chronic reaction is not actually expected, and it's really not as common. And again, please don't feel badly about knowing this. This is actually really good news for everyone. You know, it's a testament to just how incredibly resilient we are. So if any of you are out there and you're like, yeah, I went through all this trauma, but I don't feel like there's anything wrong with me. Well, yeah, you're in the majority of people who recover, right? On their own or with or without help. And I think once we have a better understanding of trauma and how things like PTSD develop, then, you know, it really empowers all of us to not only recover, but prevent the development of chronic symptoms and problems, you know, right after a trauma. So we'll stop here for today. I know this is a lot. It's a really heavy and also potentially painful topic. So I'm trying to introduce ideas over the course of this series in small, very digestible bites. So I hope that I have accomplished that. Be sure to tune in for the next episode in the trauma series. And if you didn't already do this after listening to part one, again, I want you to ask yourself this. How do you define trauma? And do you think you have experienced trauma in your life? If so, how did you react? Did it lead to any noticeable changes in you or in your home or work life? Or did things change in your interpersonal relationships? And finally, now that you've learned about the stress diathesis model, what are the factors that you can identify or think of from that long list that I outlined that you think might have contributed to your increased risk of developing a long-term trauma disorder or symptoms of anxiety, depression, or trauma? And one thing that can be very, very helpful is pulling out a piece of paper and just listing all of those different factors and then going through, you know, all of your historical knowledge. Once you start to put the pieces together, it's actually quite validating. And my hope is that you'll start to feel some compassion for yourself and everything that you've been through. And once again, to reiterate and leave you always on a hopeful note, if you are someone who is currently suffering from the aftermath of a traumatic life experience, please remember that trauma is treatable. Trauma-related symptoms can and often with treatment do resolve completely and also in a pretty short amount of time. Humans are incredibly resilient, and that includes you. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope that you've learned at least one new thing that you can practice this week. Please feel free to share feedback and submit ideas for future topics at happywizardpodcast@gmail.com. Take care. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again.